Welcome to Beyond Your Newsfeed, Understanding Contemporary Politics, a podcast of the Providence College Political Science Department. My name is William Hudson, Professor Emeritus of Political Science and host of this podcast. My guest today is my colleague Gazim Zinzerci, Associate Professor of Political Science and an expert in Middle East politics. Professor Zinzerci's new book, The Muslim Social, Neoliberalism, Charity, and Poverty in Turkey, has just been published by Syracuse University Press. In this book, she explains how Turkey's ruling party and other Turkish actors have melded modern neoliberal reforms and traditional understandings of Islamic charity to create a form of public welfare provision that she calls the Muslim Social. I'm delighted that she has agreed to join me to discuss her new book and its intriguing argument. Professor Gazim Zinzerci, once again, welcome to Beyond Your Newsfeed.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, I would like to begin way at the beginning, Gazim. What got you interested in the topic of your book? Was there a particular puzzle or question that you started out with as you embarked on your research?
So all the way at the beginning, I became interested in charity because I started noticing new kinds of charitable advertisements in the media in Turkey. So this included, let's say, an NGO advertisement in a newspaper, TV advertisements, trying to get people to give to specific charity organizations around religious holidays, but also secular ones too. And this might be a little surprising because in the United States, we see these kinds of advertisements all the time. But it was not the case when I was growing up. When I was growing up in Turkey in the 80s and 90s, charity was more of a neighborhood, informal, family kind of affair. It wasn't something that was organized through big organizations, and most people would not give to non-governmental organizations. The very idea of having an advertisement to collect money was entirely new. And at the same time, I really became interested in how these advertisements were representing, let's say, poverty, what kind of slogans they were using to get people to give. Were they emphasizing religious slogans or were they talking about secular ones such as, let's say, goodness or solidarity? And what did the poor look like? Were they happy? Were they suffering? So that was really just really intriguing to me. And that was the starting point. What made it puzzling was that the literature on neoliberalism suggested that the more a country became capitalist and market-oriented, the less emphasis there would be on social relations and responsibilities. So one would assume that we shouldn't be seeing an increase in charity initially, I thought, instead of a decrease of it. So that was the more theoretical puzzle.
Yeah, to back up a bit, by neoliberalism, we mean this movement that's often associated with the 80s and 90s in the United States, associated with the policies of Ronald Reagan, for example, which emphasized privatization of social services, emphasis on market relationships, promoting deregulation of business and the like. And so Turkey was affected by that as well. And you thought that should mean that people would be less focused on charity or social welfare.
So yes, that's what I mean by neoliberalism. And of course, it happens differently in different countries. But generally, having a more market-oriented economy with less state control and privatization of a variety of social services. However, in countries like Turkey, it may not always mean privatization of social services. And alongside my interest in charity, that's another thing I noticed, was that the government was spending more time, energy, and money on social services instead of spending less of these kinds of efforts, which also contradicted assumptions about what capitalism would look like.
And that's certainly a contrast with, say, the United States or Europe in the 1980s. I can think of Margaret Thatcher, for example, privatizing public housing, really drastically reducing social service spending. There was considerable reduction in social service spending, even in the United States. So we associate this marketization of neoliberalism with withdrawal from the social regime. But you say in Turkey, the opposite happened.
Well, that's what I thought initially. So that was the puzzle. But you're correct that Margaret Thatcher is a good example in the United Kingdom. She even said something like, there is no society but only individuals, emphasizing that we should all be looking out for our own interests and not trying to rely on public support. So that was the starting point. And this was interesting for me because I thought that I could learn something new about capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, by studying Turkey. But I was also very intrigued with charity because I think charity is a kind of a window into the soul of society. And in my research, it was also a window into the soul of a changing society. And I wanted to understand the kind of changes that were happening while these charitable advertisements were popping up everywhere.
So with these questions in mind, you embarked on your research plan, made a number of field trips to Turkey to interview people. Tell us a little bit about that. How many field trips did you make, and who did you talk to? Who did you think you needed to talk to find out answers to your questions?
So I made total of 4 or 5 trips, but the initial one was almost a year long, maybe even more. And when I started out, part of it is I didn't exactly know where to start, so I kind of had to find my own way. And I started eventually interviewing volunteers and managers of Islamic non-governmental organizations.
That's an important point to emphasize, that often researchers don't know where to start, but you just have to start doing something and try to figure out exactly what the right path is, right?
Yes. I mean, I had some ideas about where to go and what to do, but it's also interesting because the research kind of takes you where it needs to go. So I also spent a lot of time in the National Public Library in Turkey trying to read about the history of charity and various kinds of Islamic charitable traditions. I also interviewed bureaucrats and people who were working at small public welfare wakfs in Turkey. But I'd say it's really the best advice I got about fieldwork was just make sure you get out and do something every day. And that was the advice I took for the first about 6 months when I didn't quite know where I was going with the project. I just knew that I was interested in charity and social service provision. So every day I tried to go either talk to someone in this general realm of affairs or find a book or an article or go to the library and get more information. And that part I really enjoyed, actually. It was difficult. It is difficult, but it's also very fulfilling.
And how receptive were people to the questions you had to ask about charity? How difficult was that to approach, say, bureaucrats or someone in an NGO and start asking questions? Were they eager to talk about their work? Were they reluctant? Were they concerned about bad publicity? I know when I've done that kind of work myself in the United States, those kinds of problems sometimes come up.
Mm-hmm. So when I first started the project, it was a comparison of secularists and Islamists in Turkey. And so that meant that I was moving between two very different groups on a daily basis who are quite politically on opposite ends of the spectrum. And I had assumed that that the secularists would welcome me with open arms and the Islamists would be very hesitant, the Muslim NGOs. But it turned out to be the opposite. The secular Kemalist non-governmental organizations were very hesitant talking to a scholar coming from the United States. They didn't want to let me interview them. They thought I was suspicious of their actions, and they were suspicious of me. I mean, some of them told me that, you know, I was working for the US, or maybe I was a CIA agent, which I thought was very funny, because why would CIA want to learn about a small non-governmental organization in Turkey?
That's how sneaky they are.
Apparently. So that part was surprising, but Islamic non-governmental organizations were very open and welcoming. And I think that's also not because of their personality or because they're good people, although they are good people. It was also a governmental concern there that they had been told to make sure everybody can come and ask them questions, because they were accused a lot about corruption, being involved with political vote buying, bribery, other kinds of issues. So it was part of their self-presentation to make sure that anybody who had questions can come and talk to them. So that was helpful. But there were also a variety of awkward interactions with people I interviewed. And I talk about this when I teach about how to interview, that sometimes you can use who you are as a tool. So often I would act like a young student who doesn't know quite what she's doing. And I'd be like, oh, I have this homework about charity. I wouldn't say those exact words, but I would let the people tell me what I should know, because they really didn't think I knew anything. And there were a lot of patronizing interactions with people who wanted to teach me the correct way to study charity. But I gathered a lot of information from those interactions.
Right. Yeah, one of the little techniques that interviewers use, right? You can adopt different persona with different subjects and the objective is to get them to talk and tell you what they're doing. So there are a variety of ways of doing that. So exactly when did this idea of the Muslim social began to coalesce in your mind in the process of your research?
In the process of my research, it was a couple years into the project. It wasn't something that came up really easily. And the reason was because this is something I think we all do as researchers. I was reading literature and I was trying to let the literature lead me to the answer, whereas it would have been better to let the data lead me to the answer. So I'd say at some point I started to let the people who I interviewed tell me their stories in my mind and on paper. And that's when I started moving towards the idea of a Muslim social. And this social as a term does exist in the literature. There is, you know, a famous book by Jack Danzelot, who studies the social in France. There is one on the post-Soviet social. So after, you know, comparing what was happening in Turkey with these kinds of works, I came to realize that there was a similar phenomena that no one had studied or pointed out.
And what is this concept of the social in those works and that you found in Turkey?
The main idea here is that society becomes something to govern, with specific techniques and governmental interventions. And it's a Foucauldian idea or post-Foucauldian idea, but part of modern liberalism is to make society into something that is governable through bureaucracy, through documents, through categorizations. And this is the story of the, you know, modern era. We want to quantify and understand and calculate. And we come up with a lot of different mechanisms to make it manageable and governable. So basically, society becomes a separate sphere that governmental authorities need to really understand and cultivate and manage and govern through a variety of mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Muslim part of that then, the Muslim social? How is that different from, say, the social in France?
Well, so the question here is, I think, a little better explained if you think about social services in the Middle East or the Muslim world. Because in, you know, let's say in the Middle East or the Muslim world, there are a couple of options. But in general, these countries have adopted secular social service provision, adopting sometimes from European institutions and approaches.
So in that way, it's like France. Okay.
In that way, it's like France.
It's the government trying to mold the social.
Yeah, right. Through secular means, without an emphasis on religion.
Right.
What makes the Turkish case distinctive is it's one of the only instances where the government purposefully incorporates Islamic charitable organizations into the public welfare regime. Whereas there are many organizations in the Middle East, Islamic welfare organizations that provide social services to the poor, they often work outside of the government and sometimes kind of critical of the government. So they provide, there's an entire literature on Islamist social services, but it's never really part of the governmental regime. So that's where the Muslim comes, is the government, the state begins to use Islam as part of its welfare regime. And this isn't, this doesn't mean a return to, you know, golden Islamic times, but it's just kind of a rhetorical and practical use of religious sentiments. And in that way, I think it's similar to, you know, compassionate conservatism or big society debate. So it's not entirely different from United States or the United Kingdom.
Faith-based initiatives. That was the big George Bush's attempt to mold the social. Faith-based initiatives. So if we talk about interjecting sort of Muslim values into this context, what is the Muslim tradition in regards to charity and welfare, and what are some of the major concepts that then are going to be utilized by the government along with these managerial techniques of governing the social?
So, I mean, Islam has a lot of rules and traditions about how Muslims should give to charity, and some include waqf making. Waqfs are religious endowments. There is also zakat, which is compulsory giving money to the poor. There are 8 categories that you can give, but mostly to the poor. There is sadaqa, which is voluntary almsgiving. And there are also other less scriptural, but still important for Muslim practices around the world, kind of charitable practices.
Right. The waqfs are kind of like philanthropies, right? They're, I mean, an analog might be the Ford Foundation in the United States. A rich person leaves money. Waqfs are sort of like that.
They are similar. Yeah, most people would consider waqfs as a foundation, although the meaning of waqfs can be a little different than a philanthropic foundation under certain circumstances. And those kinds of differences really come into play when people talk about, you know, what is the proper way to give in Islam. And the point that I was really, you know, both struggling with and trying to understand was, how are these Islamic charitable traditions and practices and institutions understood and reimagined in Turkey today? Because while there is this general tradition of Islamic charity, sadaqa, waqf, or infaq, they really differ tremendously, and they're open to interpretation, and they are open to fluidity. And that was really eye-opening for me to see how these practices were reimagined and redefined by both the government, but also people interested and involved in social service provision.
And why was this important to the Erdogan regime, the AKP? Maybe we should say a little something for our listeners about the emergence of the AKP and how their approach to governance was a contrast with the secular Kemalist approach rooted in the work of Kemal back in the 1920s. And could you say a little something about that so we can then bring that into your work in the Muslim social?
So Turkey has been founded in 1923 by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk and the Kemalist ideology.
And the which was secular.
which was very secular, emphasis on ethnic Turkish nationalism. And the idea was that it would be best to leave Islam in the private sphere and not bring it into public and governmental affairs. This is more or less been the fundamental way of governing Turkey up until the 1980s. Now, of course, there are some new interpretations of Turkish history, which suggest that there was always a little bit of religion here and there. It was just not expressed very strongly or very explicitly. But when Islamic political parties, starting in 1980s and 1990s, began to rise to power, the Welfare Party in 1990s, the predecessor to the AK Party, they really questioned the fundamental principles of the Turkish secularist regime. And one of the strategies they used to come to power was to really bring up the religious aspects and emphasizing that without religion, the elite couldn't connect to the people. So there were a lot of tensions and, you know, postmodern military coup in 1997, etc. But in the end, what happened was this more, I wouldn't say radical, but maybe, you know, anti-systemic Islamic political party or movement became moderate. And it resulted in the formation of the AK Party in early 2000s. And there were a lot of questions in Turkey about whether AK Party would survive, because any Islamic political party or movement before then was often shut down by the secular military establishment, or they would disappear for a variety of reasons. But AK Party was successful in staying in power, and maybe too successful eventually. And one of the reasons its success was attributed, especially in its first two terms in office, was a successful molding of Islamic values and neoliberal economic reforms that pleased both the World Bank and the IMF, as well as the European Union. So initially it was a pro-Western, pro-democracy, but also a kind of a conservative Democrat kind of political party. There has been in the last 10 to 15 years a shift towards authoritarianism and also shift in the Islamic ideologies of the party. Does that answer your question about the party?
That's some good background. So this party really comes to power in the early 2000s. And its leader is Erdogan, the current president of Turkey. And so why would they be, you mentioned that they actually expanded social provision with this, you know, Muslim social model. Why would they be interested in that? Why would that be important to them as a political objective?
Well, there were a couple of reasons why this was necessary, or it was a political objective for them. One is, once they adopted neoliberal economic reforms, it was clear that that was going to generate inequality and unemployment and poverty in the country. So they needed to expand social service provision in order to counteract those kinds of issues. So that was one of the reasons.
Yeah, and prior to this time, Turkey had never established a kind of European-style welfare state with a lot of universal programs like Social Security or widespread unemployment compensation or public housing, things like that.
Well, there were many provisions. I wouldn't say there were none. There were Social Security, pensions, unemployment benefits, but it was very ad hoc and patchwork-like. So that was one problem. Another problem was that they didn't have much poverty relief programs like food stamps or payment for the poor. And that was something that the AK Party wanted to establish. I wouldn't say there was a very widespread welfare regime like the kind we understand in Europe. But there was also the problem of many of these programs were ineffective or corrupt or didn't work very well. So AK Parti also wanted to address that. Another reason they needed to do this was there were a lot of Islamic charity organizations that were operating during the 1990s. And many of them were very informal and amateur, but also political activists. So the AK Parti needed to kind of get them on the government side and get them included and feel that they had something to do. So part of the creation of the Muslim Social was to incorporate these Islamic NGO networks into the public welfare system, both to use them to provide social services, but also to make sure they don't become critical of the government. So it was a win-win situation.
Okay, that's very interesting. So let's get kind of into the meat of your book. Your book is built around an analysis of four what I think you call assemblages, various ways of producing this Muslim Social in some very different and nuanced ways. I wonder if you could maybe talk about at least a couple of those. For example, one of them you talk about how certain organizations that provide social services begin to provide them as though they are reproducing kind of Ottoman style services that they portray as having existed in the past in a more modern context. How did that work?
So one of the chapters is called, the first chapter that gets into the meat of the argument is called Civilizational Revival and Good Governance. And in this one, I talk about Neo-Ottomanism in Turkey. And Neo-Ottomanism is a very broad concept. There is a concerted effort in Turkey to revive, in the minds of people who support it, various kinds of Ottoman institutions, traditions, and practices. So in my research, in my fieldwork, I found a lot of people talking about vakıfs, Ottoman vakıfs, in a way that was quite nostalgic and really aspirational. And the way they expressed the sentiment was to talk about how there was a glorious Ottoman civilization, where social services were provided by vakıfs almost automatically, locally, without any kind of pressure or demand from the central government. And this was an aspired model for civil society organizations in Turkey. And that part was really interesting to me because it was never something I had heard about vakıfs in that way throughout my education. Like high school education, etc. I didn't even think about vakıfs as civil society organizations initially, to be perfectly honest. So that was a kind of claiming ownership to the concept of civil society from an Islamic perspective. If you look at debates about Islam and civil society in the 1990s, there were questions about would any religious organization be even considered part of civil society? So there was a lot of pushback. But now here were all these Muslim intellectuals, volunteers, managers really owning up to the idea and even telling me we had civil society before even the West did. Civil society was born in Ottoman lands. So I wanted to explore that idea of civilizational revival, which is very, you know, not just specific to Turkey. If we look at debates in India, Russia, China, the idea of a civilizational state is very prominent in terms of how they envision themselves as new superpowers and how they position themselves vis-a-vis Europe, or in their mind what Europe stands for. So that was the starting point for the civilizational revival chapter. And then I got into ideas about what is the best way to govern the social in terms of state-civil society relations. Should state have the upper hand? Should civil society organizations partner with the state? Is it better to just one or the other to do? And everybody I talked to had a different idea about state civil society relations, and not all of them were emphasized the democratizing or mobilizing role of civil society. Instead, the idea was that it's better if civil society supports our government and stands with our government, which is quite problematic, you know, as a political scientist, because one of the roles of civil society is to criticize the government and question the government.
Right. But it's very different than the United States, where we usually portray civil society as an alternative to the government, like the argument that says, well, you don't need government programs because we have all these interest groups and we have the civil society organizations that are taking care of things, and government can step back. So this concept was civil society, in fact, is helping the government out in a very direct way.
Well, that was one of the main interpretations, but there were also other interpretations that would say the state doesn't have to do anything or the government doesn't have to do anything because civil society is taking care of it. So it's similar to the way you put it. And that's one of my, you know, one of the things I tried to do in this book is to combine these multiple interpretations and understand them together instead of just focusing on one single way of understanding what civilizational revival meant for the people who were talking about it in Turkey.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about one of your other chapters. So the next chapter is about populism. So the emphasis here is on Turkey as kind of a more nationalist. Turkey is a kind of a cultural model as a national entity rather than the Ottoman past, right?
What do you mean by a cultural model?
The idea that it's the Turkey is a culturally superior kind of a superior culture. I don't know if I understood the chapter correctly.
That's
connected often to discussions of populism, where the populace says, "I'm for the people because we the people." I mean, Donald Trump does this, you know, put America first. America is the people, and we're this extraordinary, wonderful group.
I think there's definitely an element of not maybe, I wouldn't use cultural superiority, but national power or national superiority. So definitely I agree with that. And there's also the emphasis on, you know, I am here for the people, or that I am representing the people of Turkey in a way that, you know, nobody else has ever represented the needs of Turkey. So one of the main aspects of populism is this discourse of us versus them, and a discourse of the, you know, we are standing up to the elite. So this is something we also see in Turkey, in that, you know, Erdogan represents himself or believes himself to be the victim of the secular Kemalist establishment, even though he has been in power for now more than 20 years. So it's really interesting that he does that. But what I really wanted to talk about populism wasn't that, like, I'd say big P populism, but the small P populism of how people who were working in social service provision thought that the small changes they did to giving aid to the poor were actually ways of protecting the dignity and autonomy of the Turkish people. And they believe that they were influenced by this populist rhetoric of the government, but they also had a vision of, you know, really helping the people. So sometimes their interpretation was more left-wing than the government's interpretation of populism. And I wanted to acknowledge that too, that not everybody who was supporting the AK Party or working in a government-affiliated non-governmental organization was doing it for exclusionary purposes, but they really believed themselves to be expanding Islamic community or community building among the poor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so in providing these social services, they, in a sense, were saying, we're expressing sort of the national character of Turkey in a way that showing the poor that in fact they are being taken care of by the state or the community.
Exactly. Yeah. And the key point, one of the key points here is that the nation is a Muslim nation. But Islam plays a very important role, because if Kemalists had known about Islam or had actually lived an Islamic life, the argument goes, they wouldn't have been so divided or divorced from the true needs of the people. But the interesting part here is that with this idea of serving the people in an Islamic way, the people who were involved in social service provision came up with very unexpected ideas about how to do this. So in this chapter, I talk about things like the social market, the social card, and each one of these are technologies of helping the poor. And it's actually my favorite chapter because I was just, each time I went to a social market and
the social... Yeah, what is a social market? Describe that.
So a social market is something that Islamic NGOs and public welfare vakıfs in Turkey both have. That is a room adjacent to the NGO that includes every single item that they can give to a poor person who's applied for aid, ranging from shoes to rice to cheese to kids' jackets, etc. But the key point here is that it is set up like a commercial supermarket. So it really looks like from the outside, like somewhere you could go in and shop. It will even have shopping carts and checkout counters. But the entire idea here is that instead of giving money to the poor or just giving them some goods ourselves, we're going to let the poor come in, walk around, pick the kinds of things they want, whether it's rice or milk or cheese or formula or shoes, and they're going to have a real shopping experience. And this real shopping experience was very important because for the people who were designing these new programs, it meant that the people were free. The poor people in Turkey were free to get what they want. And that was, in their eyes, a way to revive another Ottoman tradition, Ottoman sadaka stones. But I thought that, you know, imagination of the Ottoman past combined with this very technological, commercial kinds of technologies, including debit cards, was a strange assemblage that I really was fascinated by.
Right. The traditional Islamic practice, if I understand from your book, was that when someone gave the charity, they gave it anonymously, like deposited something in a poor box, and then the poor person came and took it away anonymously and didn't feel ashamed or anything like that. And this is supposed to be the functional equivalent of that.
Exactly. Right. Yes. But it was a very modernist version of this antiquated tradition. But in Turkey now, these, you know, so-called sadaka stones are like, everybody talks about them that are involved in social service provision. And they would constantly bring it up when they were explaining to me what they were doing. That was new, but also not that new.
And with high-tech things like debit cards and
exactly, yeah,
and everything. So that's very interesting. So we're being Islamic and Muslim by this provision of social welfare that doesn't demean the recipient, makes the recipient, gives the recipient some agency to pick out the kinds of things they need, not being told what they need. Right.
Exactly. And that was very important. Of course, now I say this, people who listen might think, oh, she's praising the AK Party, which, you know, I'm not necessarily doing that. I also talk about the problems that these systems brought. And so even though they had this idea of the social market, which they thought would be, you know, freedom enhancing and give people what they want, in reality, it didn't always work that way. There were a lot of problems with the system. Sometimes the poor were turned away. They were told to just get on with it. Or they were told, oh, you know, we're just going to give you this box. We're not going to let you in the social market. So there was a lot of distance between aspirations and what actually happened when it comes to poverty provision.
Yeah, and the poor people don't get to pick what's on the shelves, right?
And sometimes they are expired goods given by business organizations who want to be on the right side of the government.
And I presume the people who go to these markets aren't supposed to complain if something isn't there that they want, right?
Exactly. Or they're just supposed to be pleased because presumably they're having almost a shopping experience.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. One of the chapters that intrigued me too is the one where you talk about spiritual sanctuary. And here's, in this chapter, you talk about volunteerism and volunteers. Could you talk a little bit about that and how that fits in this concept of the Muslim social?
So one of the things that happened with the Muslim social was a rise in volunteer opportunities, both secular, liberal, and for Muslims that or identify as Muslims. And I was always intrigued by this because when I was going to college, this had just emerged, the idea that university students should be doing volunteer trips to help the poor. And this became a very widespread practice through private universities, then public universities. And there is a lot of questions about whether this is actually truly serving society or whether young people are doing it for ulterior motives. You know, what makes volunteer work truly meaningful, basically, and political? But the truth is, these organizations would not work without volunteer support. So I wanted to understand what was motivating these volunteers to join these kinds of organizations. And one might assume it was just religion, that they just wanted to serve Allah in the eyes through this charity work, which is very prominent in Islamic religion and Islamic revivalist movements. So that's where I started. But then as I got into it, it turns out people have a variety of motivations. And not all of them are religious. Instead, what I found was the primary driving motivation of volunteers was emotional well-being. And they express this by kind of an individualist framework that sometimes included religion and a desire for eternal salvation. But it was really about happiness, getting out of depression, getting some friends. And I wanted to show the tensions between these multiple motivations people had and how they struggled with, you know, religion, the personal motivations, political motivations, moral motivations, and how that gave meaning to their volunteer experience. So this chapter is really about the stories of three volunteers and how they experienced the Muslim social as someone who was participating in it.
Yeah. Could you quickly describe one of those people that you think is perhaps most illustrative of what you're talking about?
One of the people that, you know, I talked about, you know, her name is Aisha. Her name isn't really Aisha, but she is very religious and she...
I'm glad you picked that example. That was my favorite one.
Yeah. And she is religious. She's young, but she is, she has gone to the Hajj, which is something usually people do when they're much older. And she is really interested in volunteer work as a form of religious worship. For her, the most important emotional practice of volunteer work is the duty or the, you know, experience of patience. So what's interesting about her is that she is practicing patience as a way of becoming a better Muslim through volunteer work, but she's also kind of telling the younger volunteers that they're not in it for personal happiness. That personal happiness or making friends or, you know, having fun should not be part of the Muslim volunteers' repertoire, which is, you know, her specific interpretation, because for many other people, those were very important aspects of the emotional experience.
And there's some irony there because personal happiness seems to be her motivation, her happiness that she connects with being a good Muslim, right?
Yes, of course. And I talk about the ironies and contradictions with as much as respect as possible, because I think all human beings are, you know, we all have our contradictions. But in this case, you know, she was struggling with, you know, this. She was struggling with this tension herself too. And she was aware of it that, you know, no matter how much she says it's about religious duty, she still derived personal satisfaction from volunteer work. And that bothered her. And she tried to overcome it by, you know, acting in different ways.
Okay. Well, you know, that's one of the marvelous things about this book is that it shows us the variety of ways that this Muslim social is expressed, that there isn't one thing that's going on, but a multiplicity of different things. But all of them are making this connection between what are seen as Islamic values and some kind of effective way of providing social provision. So let's get to your bottom line here. So this thing, Muslim social, what's the big takeaway? Is this a good thing, a bad thing? What's most significant about this thing that you've described in such wonderful detail in this book?
I think the bottom line, I mean, it's a little theoretical, but I'll still put it forward. When we discuss capitalism, there's often the idea that community is an opposition to market values, that if we want to resist capitalism, especially if we talk about, you know, leftist perspectives, that we should return to community and solidaristic practices and caregiving. And what my book shows is that, in fact, community is quite internal to how capitalism works. So instead of imagining community as an alternative, we need to actually look at how community is governed and what kind of political and economic consequences does that act of governance have. So in the book, I emphasize, my main point is that the Muslim social governs society through an emphasis on managerial techniques and also emphasizes emotional well-being. And that's different from a type of governing society that emphasizes that it's a political problem and highlights structural issues and inequality and mobilizes on behalf of the poor. Because even though all the people who are involved in the Muslim social are helping the poor, they are not out there protesting or knocking on doors or demanding raises, right? They're all kind of working around the government to help people in the best way they can. But one could also say they contribute to the depoliticization of this entire network. And that's, I would say, the bottom line is sometimes the desire to do good might not always lead to an overall improvement of social issues.
Right. So you're actually kind of demobilizing people and telling people, well, you have no right to complain. Don't get together and organize and demand social justice. The state, the Muslim social is in fact taking care of you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And that's one of the, you know, big takeaways, I think, for me in terms of understanding the AK Party, because like for people who study Turkish politics, whether or not AK Party has done well in terms of social services or not is a big debate. And I kind of to show what they have done, but also to say we need to change the perspective on how we assess the Muslim social.
It also strikes me that way of thinking of the Muslim social could also be very helpful to an authoritarian regime. And you mentioned how the AK Party and Erdogan have gotten more and more authoritarian. So if you're an authoritarian, you don't want people complaining. And this is one of your tools that you use to damp down that criticism or possible complaints. You have an interesting epilogue in the book about the earthquake that occurred in, was it 2023, right? Just last year, really. And interaction of Muslim social with that. And it seems to me that's one of the sort of tests of this, right? When there's this massive disaster and the Erdogan government was very much criticized at the time. So can you tell us a little bit about your reaction to that in light of this concept of the Muslim social?
So when the earthquake happened on February 6, 2023, you know, there a lot of things happened, and the government was criticized for not acting quickly, not letting people go to places that were impacted. And most of those criticisms were definitely correct, because it was a political disaster as much as it was a natural disaster. What I was thinking at the time when I was trying to write the epilogue is to think about, okay, what about the Muslim social? Because one might say that a government with such an important place they gave for social service provision could have done a lot better when it comes to earthquake, you know, in the aftermath of an earthquake.
Yeah, mobilize all these organizations that have been, you know, providing social provision and get them together to help people out.
But the key word, as you said, is mobilize. But Muslim social was not about mobilizing. It's about governing and making things manageable. So first I was disappointed and surprised, and I was like not sure how to make sense of it. But then I noticed that what the government was trying to do is to transform the aftermath of the earthquake, the people, the places, into manageable things that they can govern. So for example, in order to receive, you know, earthquake aid, you had to be registered in a specific database, and you couldn't be registered in that database if you weren't at the correct city or province. And if you weren't registered in the database, you couldn't be reallocated to a different city. So in the end, everybody had to be registered and, you know, made into something manageable. And that went with other kinds of provisions too, including how to rebuild the areas that were destroyed as a result of the earthquake. So I found that that part of the managerial logic was there. And then when Erdogan spoke, he spoke about emotions and how he was the friendly father of the, you know, earthquake victims. And I had a chance, just happened to be, to go to Turkey a month after the earthquake last year. And everywhere there were Erdogan hugging or talking to a little child posters, because infantilizing the earthquake victim. So that went along perfectly with the emphasis on emotional well-being. That was at the heart of the Muslim social. But if anybody protested or questioned or criticized the government, they were not allowed to speak up. And a lot of people got in trouble, even people who were tweeting, you know, what was happening right in the aftermath of the earthquake, trying to get help to people who were under the rubble, were put in jail by the government because they were making the government look bad. So in that way, I think the earthquake, unfortunately, really made it clear the problems with governing the Muslim social in this manner that emphasized emotional well-being and managerial techniques instead of thinking about these kinds of problems in a political way.
An alternative might have been to try to get communities to organize themselves to, in fact, rebuild, provide them with the resources. Instead, it's a more of a top-down thing where the government is saying, you need to feel better about things because we're coming in and we're going to make sure that everything's organized and things will be okay in the future, right?
Yeah, and I don't think that kind of support for local community rebuilding, it's not there even after a year, right, after the earthquake. Right. You're correct, okay. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we're going to wind it up here. This has been a very interesting conversation. I think I even after reading the book, I understand your argument even better, hearing the author elaborate upon it and talk about it. So thanks so much, Gizem, for coming and your insights into the Muslim social. And look forward to your returning at some future time to be on your newsfeed to talk some more about Turkish politics and other things as well. Special thanks to our Beyond Your Newsfeed producer, Gabriel Capella Rios, who does a marvelous job making us sound good, and also provide that little bit of music at the beginning of today's episode. And there's more to come, I understand, at the end. And thanks also to Joe Carr and Chris Judge of the PC's Office of Marketing and Communications for their continuing support. And finally, thanks to our listeners. Please like us on social media and review us on Apple Podcast. Plus, tell four friends about Beyond Your Newsfeed.